Welcome back to Core Ideas, the podcast interested in all things related to lake sediments and paleolimnology. My name is Adam Jeziorski, and as always, I'm here with my good friend, Josh Steenbott.
What's up? How's it going?
It's going pretty well. I'm just back again to work through another core reading list.
Yeah, I screwed up the title of the arc when I first posted it. Lost the, not necessary, but very slow ball core reading list. So apologies to that, but we are back again.
All my efforts at branding are wasted.
Yeah, I know.
But anyway, regular listeners will remember that the theme of this, our current episode arc, is to develop introductory reading lists for a variety of paleolimnological topics.
That's right, yeah. And in doing so, it's not going to be exhaustive. Obviously, we're just looking for several short reading lists that you might give to someone who is new to a topic, a new student perhaps, as an introduction to the literature for that topic, more of a jumping off and a review of some of the really critical or fundamental sort of papers there.
Yeah. And if you're listening to these in like a sort of a binge microscope session, this might be getting old, but we're going to recap the rules once again, because this is the first time we've had rules for one of these arcs.
And we can never assume anyone is listening to all of them. So
yeah.
If you're just joining at this one, welcome.
Yeah. And yes, we absolutely are not trying to produce comprehensive reading lists. Just we're aiming for five or so, maybe like last week we slipped a couple of honorable mentions in last time, but five key papers that will act as a primer for deeper dives into the relevant literature of a particular topic. The papers won't necessarily be the foundational papers or the first papers. So for example, we were doing genetics revolution, we wouldn't be going to Mendel or Darwin for the first principles. In part because many of these ideas have percolated through the literature and just are no longer really the best place to start. It's definitely somewhere to visit. But, and also, you know, the older you go, the less approachable some of this material can be. So trying to stay a little bit more current and approachable as like just getting your toes wet before diving into the deeper waters of knowledge, as it were. And we're going to do our best to minimize the number of reviews that we include and spread the focus around multiple authors / research groups, if possible.
That's right. And if you didn't catch that first episode, you can go back, have a look. We focused on lead-to-10 dating as a critical foundation for paleolimnology, and picked out some selections there. And I think that format actually worked out quite nicely. So what should we do next?
Well, I have an idea. As something equally fundamental and foundational to paleolimnology writ large, now that you are officially in the business of recruiting graduate students to your own research program, let's talk about your research interests.
Well, I guess you can twist my arm to talk about that. It's one thing, at least I won't have to do a lot of pre-reading to do so. Happy to do that. And if you are interested in graduate work, you could always send me an email or find me on Twitter or any of the ways to link to it. And we could have a chat if these are topics that are interested. And yeah, and then maybe we'll, I mean, you're not recruiting grad students, but you obviously have your own unique interest. Maybe we'll flip the coin at some point soon and do a reading list around your background.
Okay. And just for any potential interested grad students listening, when he says, you know, if you're interested in my research, Josh is a professor at York University. You got to advertise this a little bit better, Josh.
Well, I mean, you know, you find it in there. That's right. I'm a assistant professor at York University in the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change. And you can find our research group that's jointly run by myself and Professor Jenny Carosi, what we call limnology and paleoenvironmental research group. But you can find us there. But in doing so, you know, it's always hard to pin down what it is you're interested in, you know, what your research is. Like even coming up with the name for labs, I find quite challenging, almost limiting. Limnology, paleoenvironmental research. But I'm really interested in the North historically. I started as a graduate student and foundational to that, fundamental, literally underlying Northern research is permafrost. So I think that's what I'd like to talk about if I was going to pick a reading list out of my own research interests.
Oh, okay. So then, on like the, I guess, the biggest big picture level, what are the fundamental questions that you're most interested in?
Yeah, so permafrost is just a feature, right? And we'll get into what that is and some definitions and stuff. Not to make this a lecture, but to just set the stage. But as something so big and so present and so important to the Arctic, there's so much research on permafrost, from the geotechnical, how it behaves, what it's made up by, all of those kind of things. Whole research programs focus on one facet of the temperature of the ground and all of the things that are built on that. I'm interested sort of in the linkage between the geomorphology, so the form of the ground and how it changes and the processes that change the ground surface in permafrost regions, and how that impacts aquatic ecosystems, and particularly using lake sediments to track how permafrost is changing at the landscape level, and then what impact that's having on lakes that are downstream of those changes. Does that make sense? That succinct enough kind of two main things around permafrost?
No, that makes sense. And just for context for listeners here, I am not a northern researcher at all. All my stuff is very much focused in the temperate zone. And so if I sound like an idiot in any of my questions, it is not an act, and it is not my particular realm of study. But I do know that permafrost is massively broad in scope in general. And I think to go any further in terms of producing a list and narrowing down into specific questions and where you would start, we need some more context. Again, not just for listeners, but also myself. So maybe rattle off a couple of really quick definitions.
Yeah, for sure. And if I go too in-depth, too lecture, just cut me off, because I could talk about this for a long time, and some of it's needed contextually, but otherwise it's just a little bit of interesting, but maybe not on point kind of things. But yeah, what is permafrost is probably the first
question.
That
is what I was going to ask.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a fairly straightforward definition. It's ground that remains frozen for two or more consecutive years. So any ground that doesn't thaw in subsequent summers. So it stays frozen over the summer. The two or more just means that it can be for a relatively short duration. A lot of the permafrost has been frozen for a long, long time. Depending on where you are geographically, that could be going back for hundreds of thousands of years throughout the last glacial cycles, many cycles in some cases. So that's a very straightforward definition. The thing that gets built into that is it doesn't have any constituent in the definition of what it's made out of. So permafrost can be just rock that is cold, that stays below freezing. Just bedrock that is frozen is permafrost. Or it can be mud and ice and the remains of mammoths that died on the steppe during the you know, mid-Quaternary. And all of those things. So it's a really broad definition in terms of what makes up permafrost, even if the functional term is pretty straightforward.
Okay. This obviously leads massively into general climate change studies. So what happens when the permafrost melts?
Two things. It never does. Is the most important thing to first answer that. And that was a setup. Adam knows the thoughts on this. So melting is a state change, right? In, you know, if you think back to your basic chemistry, when a solid becomes a liquid, it's melting. Permafrost is not one solid, right? Because I just said it could be rocks, it could be water, it could be mud, it could be mammoth bone, whatever it is. There's not that many mammoths, but there are a lot in there. So permafrost doesn't melt, it thaws. And the best analogy, the one we always use, I certainly didn't come up with it. I've been told it was Vladimir Romanovsky, a professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks, permafrost researcher of great renown, many, many years of research, who came up with the analogy that permafrost is like a frozen chicken. You can't melt a chicken, you can thaw a frozen chicken. Because the bone and the meat and the juices and all those things will thaw at different rates. So that is the functional definition, and probably will be the basis for the image for this podcast, because it is one that we talk about all the time. What happens when permafrost thaws, however, really depends on what it's made of. If it's bedrock that was cold and gets warmer, so it thaws in the summer, and then refreezes in the winter, probably nothing happens. It remains rock, right? If it, however, is ice, ground ice, or soils that were very wet in constituent, more like the lake sediments the listeners may be familiar with, then lots can happen depending on the terrain. So if it's really flat terrain, you might get a pond forming. You might get subsidence, the ground sinks. And that is called thermokarst. So the subsidence of the ground when permafrost thaws is thermokarst. And then all sorts of other things. There's tons of different types of thermokarst. I couldn't even label them all or list them all, but there's lots of different landscape changes that occur when ice-rich permafrost, that permafrost that's most likely to really change the landscape when it thaws, when that thaw occurs. And it's something that's happening everywhere because our planet is warming. The northern and southern high-latitude locations are warming faster. They started warming earlier, so thermokarst and other permafrost thaw, but primarily thermokarst, is ongoing and accelerating.
Okay. So this is where I'm going to plead ignorance a little bit. So when you see those northern pictures of, you know, the permafrost thaw, and like the road is all misshapen now, and like the telephone poles are all askew, that would just generally be referred to as a type of thermokarst action?
Probably, yeah. Okay. The telephone poles askew, the drunken forest, those are certainly going to be thermokarst. They probably occur when lakes are expanding, or you have the collapse of some sort of landscape feature, like a plateau, a peat plateau. Those are thermokarst features. The undulating terrain sometimes can be just cryoturbation. You know, when you freeze, well, you freeze a water bottle that's full, it expands, right? Ice in the ground does that too. So there are other reasons, but that kind of sinking of houses, all of those subsidence kind of events, and then also the like slope movements where you get landslides of the slurry of stuff that has thawed and melted water are all examples of thermokarst.
Okay. All right, so those are the two main ones I wanted to cover. Is there anything else before we dive into the list that you think needs to be defined at this stage?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there are other things about permafrost, where it's located, how continuous it is, how thick it is. The most important sort of from what we've been talking about is really just how much ice is in it. So how much excess ice, or just how wet the ground is. A little bit about the geology, obviously, like really fine grained clay types of material are going to behave differently than sandy, silty types of material. But from a first order control on what's going to happen when thaw occurs, water is key there, and then terrain, and then geology, probably surficial geology. And I've never done any research in like really solid permafrost environments, deep permafrost. My research, because I'm interested in surficial features, lakes, primarily being a biologist by training, if not everyday work, where I guess I'm a geographer now, is in thermokarst and really slope movement. So these geomorphic changes.
Okay. All right, then. As clear as mud.
That's right.
So let's get rolling with the list. So keeping in mind, we're going to build a five-paper list here. What would you want to lead off with?
It's always a hard one. The first slot is really important one, and I'm going to pick a couple papers as we work into it that are not paleo-specific, because obviously, you know, how you can apply lake sediment techniques is super important. But understanding a little bit about permafrost broadly is contextually really, really critical. So, and I have a little bit of a connection to the first one. So the first paper is by Boris Biskoborn and a whole bevy of authors. It's a big author paper. It's in Nature Communications. And despite having, I don't know, 30 some authors, it is a short title. It's called Permafrost is Warming at a Global Scale. Published in 2019, open access, being in NatCom. So there's, you know, it's not intentional part of this process, but I think that's helpful. And so, you know, those short paper or short title papers, you know, kind of snappy, but it's a really good summary. And Boris is a paleolimnologist, and we've worked with him very tangentially in a paper that we'll talk about later. And in this paper, it's really a summary, recent summary of sort of the state of knowledge related to permafrost temperature changes in all of the different permafrost zones we didn't talk about, but going from the very, very northern continuous down to the more discontinuous permafrost, give some hard numbers on how much temperature change has occurred in those areas. And just as a good introduction to the nature of permafrost, some implications for more at a very, very small scale, big picture, looking at the whole planet, for what's happening in different kinds of permafrost, and just a good summary to kind of get you into this field. So especially if you're a paleolimnologist, kind of dipping your toes into the permafrost literature, you may have a good background in the specific science. This will give you that fundamental permafrost view.
Okay. Yeah. So for those following along at home, shortly after the episode airs, we will update the website with a list of links to all these. And because again, the names and the titles can be hard to convey quickly in audio form, but also particularly for all the papers like this one that are open access, then it becomes that much easier to disseminate.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Quickly. And you can have a look at yourself, read the abstracts, maybe read the whole thing. So that's my first choice.
Okay. So that is a very recent paper. It can't have been your first choice for very long. It's only 3 years old.
No, I don't think, I mean, being in that 2019 world and 2020 kind of thing, I only really came across it probably during the pandemic, kind of. Well, obviously we're still in the pandemic, but when kind of, you know, step back and just seeing what's going on, probably in early 2021, I think. So even more recent than that. And I think it's a good paper for there. Lots of reasons. And has a whole, you know, one of the nice things about that huge author list, I want to move on, but just to say that you have Canadian experts, experts working in Alaska, in the United States, Southern Hemisphere experts, lots of Europeans, Germany, where Boris works out of at Alfred Wegener, huge permafrost research, Asia, high latitude areas, just a really good global picture.
Fantastic. All right.
Okay.
Paper number two.
Yeah, number two. Okay, so this is the one I know best that I'm not an author on. Maybe even better than the one I am an author on at the end of this list. It's written by my good friend, long-term colleague, Steve Kukel, at the Northwest Territories Geological Survey. Came out in 2017. It is in Geology, the journal. It is also open access. I don't think that whole journal is. I think they chose to make this one so. And it is called Climate-Driven Thaw of Permafrost-Preserved Glacial Landscapes, Northwestern Canada. So we're moving now into a Canadian focus, though there is obviously implications for all northern regions, especially related to thermokarst in this case. So we're moving into, for my interests, the place where we're talking about ice-rich permafrost primarily and its thaw in the current landscape. And I love this paper. I use it in my undergraduate teaching because I think it's quite approachable. And it's just this really cool concept that they've worked with. And it's one of those great examples in that this seems like a fairly straightforward kind of concept. The idea that where we have these large permafrost thaw features, in particular, a type of thermokarst called retrogressive thaw slumps, that was what I work on primarily, that the largest ones, the ones that are rapidly thawing, accelerating, is right at the outline, the edge of the maximum of the Laurentide ice sheet. It's at the last glacial maximum. So effectively, what is now occurring is the end stage of deglaciation that's been going on for the entire Holocene. So initial deglaciation was the loss of the ground ice, the surface ice, right? But permafrost is the ground ice that's frozen down still into the ground, right? So there is this ice that is glacial ice, including the big excess pieces that we're now conducting this experiment on our planet at such a rapid rate in terms of thaw, of warming, that it is finishing off deglaciation at the margins where the ice sheets went to. And if you look at their mapping, which is one part of this paper, there's no large thaw events where they were beyond the last glacial maximum. So in Refugia, where there were no ice sheets. And it seems so simple, you know, but it's only because they've been studying these things for 25 years that they were able to piece all of this together. So that's my pitch as to why this is maybe my favorite paper, broadly.
Okay. Well, I think the main thing that jumped out at me, outside of what the general coolness of it all, is you're going to really have to define what a retrogressive thaw slump is.
Right. So I kind of did. I just didn't use the term. So retrogressive slump, or a slump in general, is a type of landslide. It's a landslide that is, instead of being linear, like a something sliding over top of a solid surface, it has this curved shape to it. So it looks like a C or a C-shaped depression that is carved into the ground. A retrogressive thaw slump is just because the initiating feature isn't like wetting of material, it's the thaw of the ice, or the melting of the ice that's there. So in areas where there's lots of permafrost, the ice will get exposed by just rain events, often just natural land movement. The sun will melt that ice, which releases kind of the containment of the ground that's sitting on top of it, and that stuff falls into the base of this slump, into this landslide, and they grow and change. Okay. And they get massive. I've been and some of the ones that are really the basis of this paper are you know, the pieces of land that are falling into the slump are like the size of buses. The slumps themselves are many, many hectares in area.
Yeah, that's kind of, I was kind of like poking towards, is that the whole idea of you have these northern lakes where you have situations where a huge chunk of the catchment can fall into the lake.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. In some cases, especially where the catchments are headwater small, you know, you're looking at 10% of the catchment area by area, not by volume, obviously, slumping into the lake, and bringing with it all sorts of the stuff. So if the geology is, you know, shale based, you know, lots of strontium and calcium and all of those things get translocated into the lake, and that's what I'm kind of interested in primarily, is what happens to the systems after. Whereas working nicely with people like Steve, they tell me about the slumps and where they are and that kind of thing.
Yeah, because just on like the most excuse me, one of the most obvious of levels is these are events associated with massive ecological change.
They can be, yeah, for sure. And in some ways, this is getting a little off topic, but I've been surprised by how little ecological change they can induce in some cases, and partly that may just be systems that are fairly disturbed a lot of the time. It's cold, it's, you know, harsh-ish kind of conditions, but also a lot of times what's entering into the lake is just melted water that was in the ground, and the amount of sediment, soil, it can be maybe less than you would imagine. Still significant. Okay.
Cool. Well, we definitely have to include like a really good picture of one of these.
I have some of the, well, some including, I think the one in this paper they refer to is one that drained a lake. That's the final threshold. One of these slumps did eat into a valley, and there was a small lake at the top of it, and it drained it. And we can link to some of the amazing images and footage that they took when that happened.
All right. Paper number three. All right.
Yeah, I got to work a little faster here, Josh. But those are the foundational kind of background stuff. And now I want to get into some paleo examples. Finish with three paleo examples. So the first one, I mean, you could go in any order. I think we'll go chronologically for lack of a better way to do it. It's the only paper not open access.
Boo.
I know. It is from 2010, so it's the oldest paper as well. Maybe that's why. It's in Stoughton, Science of the Total Environment. It's by Johan Rydeberg and others in the research, from the paleo research community, one of the paleo research communities in Sweden. In Umea. So that's Peter Rosen, Richard Bindler, and those experts there. And Sweden, another thing about this paper is we kind of move over to Europe. You keep in mind that, you know, Canadians, we focus on Canadian examples, but from a paleo perspective, working in high latitude areas, some of the things we've talked about already from acid rain work in Northern Europe and Finland and Sweden, maybe a little bit in Norway, but really Finland and Sweden. There's this huge record of paleo limnological work up there. And yep.
Can you give us the title?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Climate-driven release of carbon and mercury from permafrost mires increases mercury loading to subarctic lakes.
There we go.
I keep forgetting the title. I did that last time as well. I got everything else. The year. Yeah. Okay. We got it. I was being too
dived right in
detailed about the authors in particular, because they do have, you know, a lot of really good work. So a lot of research has been going on there, and I don't know that this paper was explicitly interested in originally just permafrost thaw, but it was focused on understanding carbon dynamics, because that's really important for the global climate cycle and frozen ground, especially organic rich ground, like in a peatland environment, or a mire, as they call them in Europe, is a huge source of that, huge potential source of that. And also it can be a source of contaminants like mercury, especially those globally distributed contaminants. So I'm not sure this paper was explicitly about permafrost thaw. That was more a mechanism for the movement of some of those materials to lake environments. So I think that's a really good place to start. And you could kind of do similar things. And we did do some contaminant work on our looking at thaw slumps as a potential source of range of different contaminants. And ultimately it came out to some were not as important. Really local geology and then also the geography of environments is important there. So that's number three.
All right.
And the first paleo one.
All right. Then paper number four.
Yeah, moving along. Okay, so number four, back. The next two, the last two papers are in Arctic Science, which is a relatively new, not that new anymore, but relatively new journal put out by Canadian Science Publishing. Just big shout out to them. They're great supporters of Canadian science broadly. So like Facets is the journal. Facets is one of their open access broad discipline science journals, is the official journal of the Royal Society of Canada. Arctic Science has a really, really being newer, but has a broad focus in the north. CJFAS, Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences, obviously been around for many, many years. Great supporter. So I like CSP journals generally. It's where I try and publish quite a bit of our research. This paper is from 2016 by Jana Tondu and the research group at the combined powers of Wilfrid Laurier University and the University of Waterloo. And it is called, didn't forget there, Limnological Evolution of Zelma Lake, a recently drained thermokarst lake in the Old Crow Flats, Yukon, Canada. So Adam knows these folks well. We've talked about them. Actually, we haven't really done a ton of focus on water isotopes. We did talk about the pad in our isotope lecture.
Yeah, I think we would have referred to their work obliquely more so than actually named the names that round out this list, like mm-hmm. Roland Hall, who is how I got into paleolimnology many, many, many moons ago by joining mm-hmm. his lab, and Brent Wilfrid Laurier and,
yep.
and others.
Yeah. And we talked about Roland's paper quite recently. Why do I feel like we were talking about that with, or maybe that was planning for another episode. Anyway, they all come together. I don't even know what day it is.
Stay focused.
Anyway,
focused.
I know, right. Okay, so this paper, Old Crow Flats is a really interesting landscape, just broadly. It's in the northwest of Canada, sheltered by the Richardson Mountains, so it's on the west of that, almost into Alaska, the most northern part of the Yukon Territory. Doesn't have this glaciation history. Very, very flat. There's a few river, like there's one big river, the Old Crow River. But beyond that, it's all these thermokarst lakes. And being in this kind of unique location, it's really susceptible to warming like many others. And one of the other potential ways in which permafrost thaw manifests is draining lakes away. And this paper was used a range of different techniques to, including some paleo stuff, obviously, to look at the conditions around the drainage of this lake as another really important mechanism for permafrost thaw. And there's been work that's continued. Kevin Turner at Brock University continues to work up there, as I think do Brent Roland.
Cool beans.
Oh, that and oh, I don't think I mentioned, sorry to cut you off, that if I didn't, Arctic Science is open access. So we, yep. these last two will yep. fall into that
category. So, yeah. So we're three or four so far have been open access. And so we continue on with number five. And then maybe we'll
number
do a recap
five.
At the end.
Perfect. Okay. So I'm on this one. I'm the fourth author on this one. It is
disqualified. Also Arctic Science.
No, we didn't say anything about self-citing. Is Jana on this one? No, but Boris is. Brent and Roland are on this as well. Reinhard Peenitz, we all know well. The paper is led, though. The lead author is Frederick Bouchard, another good friend of ours.
This is a shocking author list that I know almost everybody on this relatively long list personally. That's kind of funny.
That's right, yeah. And the paper is called Paleolimnology of Thermokarst Lakes, A Window into Permafrost Landscape Evolution. So this is a review. It's the first review, I think, in any of our, two core reading lists, where we basically all got together under Fred's wonderful leadership to put together some of our ideas about our own research and just how permafrost and thermokarst specifically manifests and how paleolimnology is a useful tool for tracking those kind of changes. And really it is broad. We have the Old Crow examples. We have my own work in the Delta. We have some more Southern Canadian examples from that Jenny has led and continues to work on. I mean, this is now 6 years old, so we could do an update of this and it would definitely have grown. Work by Fred in northern Quebec, especially on thermokarst lakes there. Andrew Medeiros, I think, I can't remember exactly where he was contributing work from, either the Hudson Bay lowlands or some other stuff in Old Crow. And then also Boris, we got this international component added into to that.
Yeah, just skimming the abstract here as you're talking. Yeah, it's like the Canadian North, Alaska, and Siberia. It's like a pretty good global coverage.
Yeah. Yeah, especially for these thermokarst landscapes. It's certainly not exhaustive. Lots of other people. But from a paleo perspective, that's sort of... well, that was sort of it. I think it's probably grown a little bit, which is great in those years since. But at the time, that were the people we knew and could bring together for this example. Yeah, and it really talks a little bit about techniques, a little bit about the variation and just how diverse a topic it is, but how paleo can be a really useful way, depending on the indicators and all of the stuff we talk all the time about, to track permafrost thaw and landscape evolution and just how those landscapes change.
Cool beans. All right, there we go. Five papers. That's introduction it. To permafrost paleolimnological research, I guess. I don't know how you would like encapsulate it in like a sentence of...
Yeah. Yeah, I would have to think about that a little more. Probably, I mean, we do have obviously permafrost broadly, but changing permafrost landscapes in paleolimnology, something like that.
There we go. And yeah, covering various aspects from it and just permafrost in general, it's paleolimnology, and then a review at the end. So I'm assuming this is a list that you would happily, if not have already, sent out in a welcome to the project type email address with a stack of PDFs for an overwhelmed student here and there.
Yes, I would. Yeah, for sure. And I think they're pretty approachable. I wouldn't say these, you know, there's not that many equations in those papers.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. So that is our list. You may disagree, and that's fine. But as I'm reading through these, a couple of questions came to mind as like the outsider on this particular show, is that these are all fairly recent. Like, I mean, the oldest paper in your list is from 2010. And you think of like last time we were like going, should this one from the 70s be included or not? Like, so does that mean the study of permafrost thaw in this way is a relatively new discipline? Or is it just... like, I don't know. I just found that kind of shocking when you threw this together.
I don't think it's new. I think it's rapid. It's expanding, and so you know, there are great papers from back. You could have easily put in some papers from the early 2000s, late 90s that are excellent examples. And on a different day, I probably would have if I'd been thinking about those. Probably not going to get them open access. Generally, you know, the world was different then, and that wasn't all that important. But it does come into play in my mind, and yeah, it's just that there's so much research; it's growing so rapidly that you have a lot to choose from, and so you can pick some really new examples of that. And from the paleo perspective, I think those are relatively new. Because you have to identify the problem, you have to understand it fundamentally. And there was lots of permafrost research going on in the 70s. Amazing work by Ross Mackay and many, many others. But then from a perspective of tracking those changes, understanding the landscape implications, that is coming more recently as the paleolimnologists have found out about these ideas and brought their toolkit.
Cool. And then... and this is where I'm probably going to embarrass myself on the internet and show my serious geographic ignorance here. But is there, you know, we talk about Northern Canada, Alaska, Siberia. Is there a version of this story in the Southern Hemisphere? Like, I do know off the bat that there's no permafrost on the southern coast of Australia. It's pretty jungly.
Very true.
But how about... when you get into the southern tip of South America and Patagonia, it's like, is this a thing there?
Yes. So yes, it is. This is a very much a northern hemisphere. Well, okay. The Biskoborn paper is global. This was a northern hemisphere list. Other than that, there is permafrost in the southern hemisphere. It's not a very common question because you don't think of it. The land masses of the planet where they are currently are northern dominated, with the exception of Antarctica, obviously, which is totally frozen. So there's permafrost in everywhere in Antarctica. A lot of it is under the ice cap. So God forbid we melt away the entire Antarctic ice cap.
So we're ways away from studying permafrost.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But it will come. You know, all of the same things. The paraglacial landscape will emerge there. In the unglaciated areas on the islands, the archipelagos, you know, the pointy bit that kind of goes up towards South America, there's lots of research going on there. Including some people we know, so like Dermot Antoniadis at Laval, some European colleagues work in those areas and do permafrost paleo stuff there. And the British Antarctic Survey does a great amount of research everywhere, obviously. Antarctica, obviously, but also other really cold areas like Greenland. So there is. And then there's a lot of alpine permafrost, so high altitude permafrost, because when you go up in altitude, it gets colder, and that means you get permafrost. So there is permafrost in the Tibetan Plateau, an incredible amount of research ongoing in by researchers everywhere, a lot of Chinese colleagues looking at permafrost in those areas. I get asked to review more research papers on thermokarst thawing. Not so much thaw slumps, but some in the Tibetan Plateau than anywhere else, by probably 5 to 1 almost. Like, there is an incredible amount of research going on there. And there is permafrost in other alpine areas. So Patagonia, high altitude areas of the Alps, and, you know, to some small degree. So yeah, anywhere it's cold, you're going to get cold ground.
Okay. So then, what do you think are the most interesting questions to pursue in this topic going forward?
There are so many. I think, you know, I am biased, and I can talk about what I'm interested in.
That's really what I'm asking.
Yeah. So, and there are lots, you know, just, you know, every time you look at some new type of thaw it and how it impacts different kinds of lakes, there's a lot there. What I'm interested in right now is thinking about the legacy of thawing. So there has been permafrost thaw in the past, right? There were warm periods throughout the Holocene. It was warm in the early Holocene. Paleolimnologists know this. We kind of defined it, the Holocene climate optimum, hypsothermal, however you want to label it. When those happened, permafrost thawed. As it is thawing right now, as it's very warm. And I'm interested in what that has to do with current thaw, because when you thaw permafrost, you know, it changes, right? The stuff is lost. The geology changes a little bit. The water is maybe not there. And is there a linkage between these past events of warm conditions and what's going to happen moving forward? How does that change the whole situation as it refroze and now we're going to re-thaw it? Can we learn from those past thaw events about where we're going in this rapidly warming future? And I think paleo, one of the reasons I'm interested in those questions is because the only way to answer those is to go into the deep sediments in order to infer those changes. So that's what I'm kind of interested in right now.
Now we're getting to the more cheeky questions. How come you didn't list any of your own papers? Are they actually required reading for your students?
That's a good question. I'm so humble. I was on the one paper there. So there is, it's another one of those. On another day, maybe I'd have put in one of mine in particular. If there's an honorable mention, my paper, and that's kind of the basis of the review that Fred did. From 2013 in Freshwater Biology, which is my most cited first author paper. I think it just did 100 citations, which is nice. My first author one that broke 100 would be the one I would pick. It's on how diathelms responded to permafrost thaw slumping.
Okay.
So that would be my honorable mention. Okay. I do ask the students to read that one. I kind of assume a lot of them are going to be working on diatoms, so, you know, they would pick it up on their own. I don't have to tell them to.
Okay, so maybe we'll sneak that in as a link as well, as an honorable mention.
Sure.
And then wrapping up, is this episode been a pure double dip here? Is this just a list that you had in your back pocket ready to go before we even started?
No, but it didn't take too much to pull together. It was more, I had a list of 20 and I needed to think, oh, which 5 do I pick? More the like, it was probably like 5 general permafrost papers and then 15 paleo examples that I like, and which ones kind of flow into the list kind of sort of well, at least. So yes and no, not fully rather, but now I do.
Yeah,
so.
It'll be used going forward. Excellent. So,
in some ways, maybe I've codified it and I won't add anything new to my list. It's like how you never know the literature any better than the day you finish your comps, because you stop reading at that point and that's the end of it. Hopefully that doesn't become the case. I'll have to update it every year. Not on the podcast. Sorry, you don't have to listen to me ramble for 45 minutes every year, guys. Don't worry about that.
That's fine. But well, I think one thing in terms of like the codified nature of it is you're good for a walk, because that is a very recent list. It's true. Not going to be out of date too soon.
Very true.
All right. So you have
thanks
it,
for listening to me talk, everyone. I'm looking at the waveforms of the recording of this podcast, and I don't see a lot of blanks in there. But no, it was good. I enjoyed going through all of those. So thanks for listening. Hope you found one or two interesting topics, and if not, you're probably not here anymore. So
yeah, and if you want to shoot us any questions about this list in any way, if you've got suggestions for lists, throw them our way. And once again, thanks for listening to Core Ideas, the Paleolimnology podcast. If you have a question or a comment or a suggestion for a future show, please send us a note.
Yeah, you can do that at the email address, coreideaspodcast@gmail.com, or on Twitter at coreideaspaleo. We read everything you send us, so keep it coming.
An archive of our past episodes and show notes is maintained on our website at coreideas.ajesiorski.ca. The link is listed in our Twitter bio, and through this arc, I will do my absolute best to have the lists updated pretty soon after the shows go live, so you can follow along at home if you choose to do so.
Especially when I forget the title. But if you are so inclined, you can give us a rating or subscribe. Leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, wherever you get your favorite podcast. We love those 5-star ratings, comments. But to be honest, we don't get that many, so we don't care all that much. We're just here for fun.
We will actually care when we start, if you've got a couple. So,
oh, yeah.
That would be some celebrating. But that's it for today. And we'll be back soon to explore another core reading list related to paleolimnology, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy.